This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Our topic today is about love, sex, dating, relationships, marriage, not necessarily in that order. So I've talked about this subject with a number of people over the years, and it seems to me that there's just a great deal of confusion here. What's key, I think, in understanding how to find happiness in love, sex, and dating and all those things is really to figure out what the purpose of all this is. Many of the deeper explanations that I read in things like pop psychology, psychology textbooks that I had in college and in news articles and even depictions in movies, they all seem to point to all kinds of different theories in this. Like, for example, Freud, an Oedipus complex, or that unhappiness in dating and love is some sort of childhood issue or maybe even a sexual preference issue. What's your opinion on this, what seems to be this mass confusion, Dr. Lyle?
Well, of course there's mass confusion because there's a complete lack of understanding of genetics and what we're going to call behavior genetics, and also the underlying genetics that have driven the human nature. So trying to understand human romance and love and longing and all the things that take place inside of people and the challenges that are involved there would be impossible to figure out and have a coherent theory unless you have a coherent theory of human nature. So yeah, everybody else's explanations until the dawn of evolutionary psychology have been hopelessly befuddled. So yeah, that befuddlement continues and will continue indefinitely.
I want to play a clip for you because I watched a movie a long time ago, and it was a hilarious movie with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. And it's about a psychiatrist who meets this mobster, and this mobster is having relationship issues. He experiences erectile dysfunction with his mistress, and now he's worried about what's going on. This is a minute and a half clip, but it kind of gives you the state of mind of what's going on here. So let's listen in.
He was a big man in the neighborhood. Everybody loved him. Very well respected. God rest his soul.
Oh, he passed away?
No, I just like saying God rest his soul. Of course he passed away. I was about 12 at the time.
Mm-hmm. How did he die?
It was a sudden thing, a heart attack.
What was the relationship like? Were you very close?
Yeah, we were pretty close. We weren't getting along that great right then.
Why is that?
I was hanging out in the neighborhood at Bugatti.
What is that?
Like a kid gang, hooligan shit. Nothing big, but he didn't like that. So.
He didn't approve?
Nah, he slapped me around a couple of times.
And what?
And then he died.
How did that make you feel?
It felt great. It was a wonderful feeling. How did it make me feel? What do I know?
Think about it. Were you angry? Were you afraid? Sad?
Maybe all those things.
Any feelings of guilt?
About what? I didn't kill him.
I know that, but I'm just speculating, Paul, that maybe in some way you may have wanted him to die.
Why would I want my father to die?
Well, you said that you were fighting. He slapped you around because you were rebelling against his authority. There may have been some unresolved Oedipal conflict.
English.
Oedipus was a Greek king who killed his father and married his mother.
Fucking Greeks.
It's an instinctual developmental drive. The young boy wants to replace his father so that he can totally possess his mother.
What are you saying? That I wanted to fuck my mother?
But no, it's a primal fantasy.
Have you ever seen my mother?
Paul.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
It's Freud.
Well, then Freud's a sick fuck, and you are too for bringing it up.
It's...
Oh, my God. That is absolutely priceless. That is great. Thank you for... was that in Analyze This? Was that Analyze This?
Analyze this. With Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro.
I forgot that part, that sequence, but that is beyond priceless. That's great, Nate. Thanks for sharing that with us.
So this is a lot of the media depiction is that, you know, relationship issues stem from some sort of, you know, mom didn't put the toilet seat up, or dad, you know, didn't cut my hair short enough, or whatever it is.
Sure.
the other thing is that, and I've heard this from different people actually, that maybe relationship issues can stem from not knowing the correct sexuality. Whereas, you know, I think a lot of people may be afraid of, or at least maybe back 20 years ago, it was this taboo to be homosexual or bisexual, or whatever it is. And so now they were worried that if you go to a psychologist, then you become homosexual somehow.
there's confusion beyond belief. I'd see there's no end to it. So another confusion is that you marry someone like your opposite sex parent because you are attached to that kind of a person, or you've got issues with that kind of a person, or the reason why you're having problems in your relationship is because you have issues with the opposite sex because you had issues with your opposite sex parent. There were unresolved conflicts. I mean, this is just complete and utter nonsense and doesn't have anything to do with human psychology. And yet psychologists are truly like a bunch of basically like a bunch of blind snails, you know, no antenna on their head, just sort of wandering around in the slime, trying to make sense of the conflicts that humans have in relationships and romance. And they don't know what they're looking at. And that's okay. I mean, it's been that way for thousands of years. So, you know, basically, essentially all psychologists are going to be born and live their lives and die utterly confused about what they're looking at. And that goes with respect to all of their patients as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. It's a nice pleasant little opening salvo.
Yeah, every time I think of a psychologist, I think of this following clip that I'm going to play in a second.
Yeah.
About same movie, but about how people feel so much better when they talk to a psychologist. But this is the same movie. Analyze this. He starts after his first session.
It's a funny kind of a thing, but you know, I feel better after I got all that off my chest. I feel like a load. A load is off my shoulders. You're good.
Doc,
thank you.
Mr. Reedy, I didn't do anything.
Oh, you did something?
No, I did nothing.
You did something?
I didn't.
The load, gone. Where is it? Don't know. You're good. Nah. You're good, Doc. You're good. I'm going to begin to touch with you. Just one more thing. If I talk to you, and you turn me into a fag, I'm going to kill you. You understand?
Could we define fag?
Oh, my God. That's absolutely priceless. There you are.
Well, so there's that Freudian psychology for you right there.
There you are. Great stuff. It's just great stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the questions here. Let's talk a little bit about love, dating, sex, and relationships. Well, let's just start off with the biggest question that everybody wants to know. What is love?
All right. Well, love is a multifaceted set of feelings. First, we're going to break down what a feeling is. And so what a feeling is a device. Well, it's actually an experience, but an experience that requires a specific device. And that device is a neural circuit. And the neural circuit is designed to cause what you and I would call a feeling given a set of environmental contingencies. So, for example, in the tip of your finger, you've got the ability to detect changes in the environment with respect to, for example, temperature. So you've got certain nerves in your fingers that can detect whether it gets too hot or whether it gets too cold or et cetera. In the same way, you've got other nerves very, very close by. They're not the same ones that can detect, for example, the roughness or smoothness of something that you're touching. So, for example, if you touch something that's very, very rough, it will start to to stress the skin, and it may tear tissue, like a rose thorn, for example, or really coarse sandpaper, and you won't like that touch. So you're going to find out that neural circuits are not there just to go off. They go off and they create a feeling, and that feeling that they create is either positive or negative or neutral. So you can think about a feeling as being either super, super positive, up to the maximum of positive that a feeling could be, or extremely negative, as bad as it could possibly get, or in the middle, it's totally neutral and you can't even feel anything. So if you put your finger in some water that is exactly the temperature of your finger itself, you can barely feel it. You'll feel the texture of the water, but you won't feel the temperature of the water. You can't feel it. Whereas if you put your finger in cold water, if it's really cold, it'll hurt very quickly. If it's really hot, it'll hurt really quickly. If it's warm, it won't hurt. It might feel good to warm your finger up. Or if you've been really hot, and it's a hot day, and you put your finger in a cool water, that might feel good. So in other words, it's going to feel good depending upon whether or not it is aiding your survival or reproductive potential. So anything that is increasing your survival or reproductive potential is going to feel good, and anything that is reducing your survival and reproductive potential is going to feel bad. Okay? So now we know what a feeling is. A feeling is a guidance system. It's a device where that your nervous system is hooked up to the world. The sensors can feel things that are in the world. So they might see things, they might feel things by temperature, they might hear things, they might smell things, or they might taste things. In other words, there's going to be only five senses. And those five senses, each of them they are neural circuits. And the nerves are designed by nature to take a certain kind of energy that's in the world and translate that energy into a feeling. So in the case of the water, we could take another one. So you take a bite of an apple and you put it in your mouth. Feels good. Doesn't feel bad. Okay? But if we take the same size bite and it turns out that it's some dried up horse manure, it's going to feel bad. You're going to want to get rid of it. Okay? So the basic issue is we are attracted to stimuli that feels good, and they feel good for a reason. And that reason is that if we get closer and interact with it, it's going to increase our likelihood of survival. That's why we are attracted to food. That's why we are repulsed by manure and stinky water and in bacteria-infested sewers, okay? This is why we like beautiful landscapes with rolling hills and flowers and trees, etc., because those are landscapes that look like they're good for human survival. We are not attracted to something that looks like a junk heap out in the middle of West Texas where there isn't anything living, okay? So we are attracted to certain stimuli, and we are repulsed by other stimuli. And so this is the beginning of understanding what love is, because you cannot understand love unless you understand that it's a feeling, and you can't understand why love would exist until you understand that why feelings exist. Feelings exist as guidance systems to tell organisms when things are either profitable or dangerous with respect to survival. There is nothing more profitable than a romance for a human. So a romance for a human, a really steamy hot romance, is the whole point of your existence. You were designed by nature to reproduce DNA. In order to reproduce DNA, you're going to have sex. In order to have sex, you're going to have to find somebody to have sex with. If you have more than one option, you're going to have to choose between those options. Okay? And then what you're designed to do is to choose the best option. And so the best option is going to be the most totally attractive individual that you can get to have sex with. And that individual we are going to like that process very much. Another way of saying we like something very much is to say we love it. Okay? So we love a great tasting, pizza. We love a great funny joke. We love a great, beautiful landscape. We love things that are very attractive. We love a great sound of a song, and we love individuals. Okay, and romantic love is a specific kind of love that incorporates intense sexual attraction, that is what that is. It's basically a device to tell you that one is a really, really good one, and it's better than your other alternatives, and therefore you should be trying to mix your DNA with that individual. That's ultimately what that is, and a lot of it has to do with lust, but it's not the only thing, because love is actually the feelings that we call love incorporate not just a single neural circuit that has to do with lust. It also is incorporating other neural circuits that have to do with a longer-term investment process that is involved in reproducing DNA in humans. So let me take this one more step before you can cross-examine me on this. But the issue is that in most species, all there is a lust circuit. So all that species do is they try to find the individual out there in the woods that is the most sexually attractive individual, and they try to have sex with them. That is what animals do. That's true of 97% of mammalian species. That's what 97% of mammals do. There's no such thing as romance in almost any mammal, okay? There's only a handful of mammals where they have any kind of attachment that you would call love. Human beings happen to be one of those. And the reason is that we have to do, we require long-term pair bonding for males to be attached to females in order for them to stick around and invest in their offspring. So if they're going to do that, they have to really, really like the female, not just find her sexually attractive. So they have to analyze other characteristics of the female other than her sheer sexual attractiveness. And when we start to incorporate those other aspects of the female, this is now what we're going to call love, okay? So you may be extremely attracted to the looks of a car, but if you get inside of it and you start to drive it and it has a horrible drive, then you are not going to want to buy it no matter how great looking it is. And so in that same way, human beings will not, quote, love another human being unless that other human being has a host of characteristics that make for an exciting but also palatable drive. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a little bit of sense. In fact, it makes a lot of sense. The question, though, is, you know, there seems to be a difference, though, between love and lust, i.e., a one-night stand versus going and finding somebody that you're interested in, going on a couple of dates, and then eventually turning that into a relationship where you promise each other that you won't be looking for other people in the near future.
Sure there is. So, in other words, lust requires almost no action, almost no evidence for males. In other words, all the male has to do is see that a female is extremely attractive and to him, and he feels lust. The females don't tend to be that lusty that quickly. They're a little cooler organism in general, but they're not that cool. And so, yeah, lust has to do with essentially the pre-parabonding mechanisms, the neural circuits that evolved before we evolved parabonding. So yeah, you have to understand that human nature evolved over the course of the last 3.5 billion years, and that's with a B. So people that are kind of disturbed about this, the idea that they think that we were created 6,000 years ago or something, are just going to have to choke this down if they're ever going to understand how life works. Life began 3.5 billion years ago with exceedingly
simple organisms. So you're saying there were dinosaurs too?
Yes, sure. Dinosaur bones were not planted to test our faith. So
next thing he's going to do is tell us that the moon landing was real.
Yeah, that's the other thing. So it's going to turn out that life evolved greater and greater complexity over time. And so by 3 billion years after the dawn of life, you finally had dinosaurs. So maybe a little longer than that. So dinosaurs were, very complex, fascinating organisms. They were not large-brained, but we don't know if they had anything that looked like pair bonding. We don't know if males stuck around and helped with offspring. They probably did not. Mammals also were co-evolved, a slightly different kind of an organism than a reptile. And mammals 60 million years ago were tiny, tiny little rodent-like creatures, I think about an inch tall. And they lived under the ground, they only came out at night. They were nocturnal, because otherwise they would have been eaten by dinosaur predators. So when the meteor hit the Yucatan 63 million years ago, then it all changed. And so the dinosaurs had a cataclysmic die-off, and certain dinosaurs basically remained effectively dinosaurs. So alligators and crocodiles and sharks and things like that, they're for all intents and purposes dinosaurs. And and birds, which interestingly enough are also dinosaurs, also survived. So it's going to turn out, though, that mammals then were able to come out into the sunshine, and they got very big over the next many millions of years, and they became increasingly complex. And then one thing that started to happen, then you had primate-looking creatures, little monkeys, and those monkeys got bigger and bigger until they were great apes, like us. And still, through all this time, as we march down through the dawn of chimpanzees and gorillas and so forth, we're now talking 20 million, 15 million, 10 million years ago. So now we're actually in very recent times, evolutionarily speaking. So we've gone from 3,500 million years ago to 2 million years ago. So we've gone almost the whole journey of life all the way to Africa 2 million years ago. And at that point, proto-humans that were not nearly as smart as us, but they were about as smart as a modern chimpanzee, those individuals were still operating 100% on lust. They would meet out in the woods. They're not going to meet anywhere else because all there is the woods. So they're finding each other in the woods, and they are sizing each other up, and specifically the males are mating with the most sexually attractive the females are mating with the most sexually attractive males. The males do not care about how attractive the females are because they'll mate with anything. And the reason why they'll mate with anything, which is characteristic of animals throughout nature, where the males will mate with anything, the reason why this is true is that the males are not going to stick around and invest in any offspring. So all they're trying to do is get as much DNA as they can in the next generation. So males are extremely lusty, and they are competing with each other to get to the females. The females, however, because the males are all ready to inseminate them all the time, the females actually evolve mating choice. So they are very choosy about the males that they pick, and they are looking for the most sexually attractive males. And so the females, in their minds, have standards of beauty. Now, they couldn't care less about the guy's character, whether he's funny, whether or not he's going to stick around and be a good dad, because none of them stuck around. They don't talk. They couldn't care less about any of those characteristics. All they care about is how sheerly beautiful the male is. That's all they care about. And they mated with the guys that were the sexiest. Those characteristics live on in females today. So females today still have the very same kind of equipment that is highly reactive to male beauty. Just as they were in the ancient times before modern humanity. So that is where beauty developed. Neural circuits for beauty and lust being integrated together were characteristic of female proto-humans 2 million years ago. Males did not have those characteristics. Any female was sexy. They did not discriminate. Now what we're going to find is that through various and sundry changes in life, we become a parabon species. So we become a species that where the males stick around and help with the offspring. This isn't because we're nice guys. It's because the characteristics of the ecology demanded it. And in a few species, it turned out this way. Wolves, for example, will do this. Many species of birds will do this. There are about 100 species of mammal where they will do parabon behavior. We are one of those species. When you have parabon behavior, what happens is the males now start to develop choosiness in a way that they never did before. So the males start, if they're going to stick around and be with just one female, they start choosing females very carefully for their beauty. And so males and females now both start having breaks that will be put on their behavior. So if a male sees a female, he's just not interested in screwing her. If she has to meet a certain criteria level for that to be interesting, and it has to be a criteria level that is associated with about how attractive it is that he is himself or better, typically. So the males start to get fussy, just as the females were always fussy, and now you have both sides of the species are actually only feeling lust under conditions of where the opposite sex party is considered to be attractive relative to oneself. So that is that now you wind up with suddenly the world gets a lot fussier and a lot choosier. And this is part and parcel because there's going to be something else that's developing. And that is the females are going to be starting to demand that the males stick around and that they invest their life resources in the female's offspring.
We don't have to have kids if we don't want to. So how does that change things a little bit?
Well, it actually doesn't change people's behavior and how it is that they feel very much at all. In other words, you're designed by nature to have sex with people that you would think would cause very, very fancy offspring. That's what that is. When you look at a very attractive person, what sexual impulses are is essentially a motivating mechanism for you to copy that individual, be their genes. And so it's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Like when you see somebody sexually attractive, all that's happening is your brain is saying, ooh, copy those genes. Those are really good genes to copy. And we should get our genes in the boat with their genes because in succeeding generations will want to copy those genes. So if we get our genes tied up with their genes, our genes are going to get copied a lot. And the whole point of nature, the way nature works, is that organisms are designed to copy genes. So all you're trying to do when you are having sex with somebody is you're trying to copy their genes. Now, you don't know this, and organisms have no intuition that that's what they're doing. And human beings may try to block that process, but the neural circuits are designed by nature to execute those behaviors that will cause those genes to be copied. This is a great big mathematical free-for-all is what life on Earth is. And all it is that genes are building organisms in such a way so that they will copy genes. That's what's happening.
With all this copying of the genes, though, what's the difference then with, a couple shows back, we talked about casual mating strategy and long-term dating strategy.
Yes.
Are people who engage in casual mating strategy without, you know, without this expectation of commitment, are they less evolved, I guess, than the ones who want a pair bonding mechanism?
No. What you have is we're a mixed strategy species. We are not just a pair bond species, and we're not a pure casual mating species. We are halfway in the middle, and so the it's going to turn out there's two different ways you can be a viable reproducer. You can let's suppose you're a female, and let's suppose you are a 7, so you're a 70th percentile looking female, and you've got a couple of options for how it is that you play your cards. You could try to meet a 7, but most of the time, most males that are 7s are not interested in pair bonding with a female 7 because they want to sleep up. So you could sleep down with a 6, and therefore your genes are a little bit fancier than his genes, and your kids are likely to wind up at 6.5 for sexual attractiveness. And yet, the odds of your children surviving are very high if this guy feels very committed to you and is, quote, in love with you. And why is he in love with you? Because you are a stimuli that he feels is a very high utility stimuli for his reproductive prospects. And so this is all just like he likes food for a certain reason, he likes landscapes for a certain reason, and he likes you, the female, for a certain reason, because you are a very good specimen relative to his alternatives. And so and he can tell, he's got equipment for detecting how good females are, and by good in quotes, what we're really looking at is their sexual attractiveness, which is largely a function of how many mutations they have. So the more mutations that a female has that you can observe physically, the more mistakes have been made in her creation, and therefore the less attractive she is. So the fewer and fewer mutations she has, the more sexually attractive he finds her. So in this case, R6 finds the 7 quite sexually attractive. He doesn't find her as attractive as an 8, but he can't get an 8 to marry him. So he feels committed to the 7, and as a result, the energy that he can put into life past his ability, past the necessity for him to fend for himself, he will pour into his little family, and that energy will increase the likelihood of his children surviving and thriving. Or, alternatively, play a casual mating strategy where she sleeps with a 10 who has no intention of sticking around for even a day and won't even give her as much as a sack of corn chips, okay? And so, in fact, she'll be trying to have him come over and cook him dinner and take care of him. And, in fact, I have seen situations where the females supported the males financially that were more attractive than they were. And as a result, the lazy male, all he was really required to do was to attempt to sire her an offspring every now and then. So this is another strategy for the female, and let's suppose she sleeps with a 9 who does not want to stick around. And let's suppose she sleeps with a series of 9s. So she's really not even keeping track of them, because after all, they don't even give her their true names. And so what will happen is that in this scenario, potentially sooner or later, she's going to get impregnated by a 9. Her offspring will be probably an 8 of some kind, but that 8 will not get the resources of a father. And so the question to the 7 female is, am I better off with no resources being poured into my 8 offspring, or I am better off with a lot of resources and male parental attention poured into my 6.5 offspring? That is quite a dilemma. And it is not clear what the right answer is, which is why the human female is under a lot of stress when it comes to finding a romantic relationship, because she finds herself being tugged at between these two strategies, and it's not easy for her to reconcile them.
Mm-hmm. And so the option is to, I guess it seems like there's two options. One is, in modern day society, one option is to get the 6.5 kid with a lot of resources, or get impregnated by the higher male, and then maybe try to get into another relationship and have another kid with a 6 who is now going to be pouring money into both kids.
That's actually, yes, no question. And I think that essentially happens to an awful lot of people. And so just go on Match.com and look for the girl that has a kid or two, and she's 32 years old and et cetera. And if you listen to her story, you see the ones where they say never married, okay? So it's like, well, what happened? Well, what happened is she became a single mother. And if we were to track down those single mothers, we would overwhelmingly find that the males were very sexually interesting to them. They were very attracted to these guys, and they wound up pregnant, and they chose not to terminate those pregnancies, despite of, you know, in many cases, no spiritual resistance to this. But they didn't do it. They didn't want to give up that kid because that kid was pretty damn fancy. And as a result, they wind up single moms, and now what are they playing? Now they are less sexually attractive to the world because they bring a burden. But now they may be more willing to trade down. And yeah, that's a very modern phenomenon, something that you weren't seeing so often in the 1950s, because children were way too expensive for a second male to be affording to take on that kind of a problem. But in the modern environment, there's enough safety nets and enough financial strength around that a great many of our sixes will definitely take a seven. If if he can sleep up, he'll take on a stepchild in the bargain. And usually, he's more interested if she's maybe a seven and a half. Every kid costs you something if you're a female.
Yeah, so I've talked about this with a couple of acquaintances and just kind of discussed this exact type of scenario. And some of the arguments I hear on the other side is that the women who do this are, you know, these evil, you know, money-grubbing, gold-digging people, whatever. And I always look at this like it is what it is. It's anger. But what you're saying is that this is simply indicative of prosperity in society, that women are able to do this.
Sure, of course. In other words, all that people are trying to do is that they are trying to use their whatever their assets are in order to trade for the resources to optimize their life experience, and usually that means their gene reproduction strategy. So the gene reproduction strategies might be, they may not even reproduce genes, they just may want to have the greatest romance that they can. But absolutely, women are designed by nature to be two-factor production strategy creatures, which is that, number one, they want the best male that they can get, the one with the least mutations, i.e. the sexiest, most interesting, most stable male that they can get their hands on. And they also want as many resources that they can get their hands on. So the nature of their situation is that they're pushed into a situation where they are going to be compromising. Now, that compromise may seem brutal to a lot of females. In other words, it's like, look, you know, I just can't get myself. Here's a guy with a bunch of resources, plenty of resources, but I just can't get myself sexually into it because he's got too many mutations. So what am I supposed to do? I feel like I'm in a box. If only I could have, you know, that guy's body and that guy's face with that guy's money and that guy's brain, you know, and if I could just do this, you know, in the old days we had a thing called Mad Libs where you would, you know, have a little card.
I remember.
Put the people together. Sure. Okay. So this is what this is. You know, this is every night of the week in bars all around the United States and in around the world, people are lamenting the Mad Libs problem. Like, gosh, you know, I know this great guy, and he's such a sweetheart, and he's bright, and he's a good engineer, and he's got a good solid job, you know, Silicon Valley. But nah, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. You know, if he was just a little sexier like Nick over there with the tattoos, you know, God, if he could scrape up just one more point, you know, I'd be home. And
it reminds me. Yeah, you know, it reminds me of a radio show that I heard with Dan Savage. And Dan Savage is this, like, you know, love relationship columnist, and he does a radio show.
Yeah.
And he talks a little bit about polyamory and how you really can't find the one. And one of the things that I took from that is he says, you can't find the one. You'll never find your one. What you really want to do is find your 0.7 and round up.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm not exactly sure what he means by that, but I understand his principle. That yes, in other words, you're going to find that the thing is that we all know and have met in your lifetime, you will have met some people that did not feel like they compromised. And when you meet those people, it may turn out that life has eroded that feeling for them, or it may not have. And in my life as a clinician, I have run into people that from what I can tell, from every indication, they did not in fact have to compromise in this arena. Both parties felt very, very pleased by their victory in their search. they had a love and romance, and that romance may be alive and well 10 or 15 years later. Now, that is possible for our species. It is just not anything close to the norm. So what's interesting is that we see people's intuition is that what is supposed to be commonplace and they feel like should be their due, what they do not understand is that it's rare. And this is probably the greatest source of frustration for human nature that there is. The truth of the matter is that we are a Stone Age organism living in a modern environment that has tremendous opportunities to try to find idealized situations. So, for example, right now you can find an idealized situation with respect to food. You can have incredibly good food right now, food that will not cause any kinds of deficiencies or excesses in your system if it's whole natural food, and you can get it plentiful and ripe and tasty, you know, shipped into you from around the world for a pennies, you know, on the pound, and have this available to you. You can have this extraordinary existence that none of our Stone Age ancestors could have ever had. You can have that existence. You can actually sleep in a comfortable place every night that is unbelievably safe from predators, that can have no pests, no fleas, no ticks, nothing. Okay? You can have the luxurious event of having hot water come out of a shower every morning and wash yourself. It's unbelievably pleasant. You can then go down and have, you know, fresh squeezed orange juice in your refrigerator. It's like there's just no end to what is possible for human beings. They can indulge their neural circuits in an extraordinary fashion in the modern environment. They can literally indulge their wanderlust to, if they're wealthy enough, to travel the globe and see what the entire possibility of human existence looks like and choose to live in a place that tickles their particular circuits as best as they can. This is amazing that this is true. Now, the thing is that it is therefore the case, it is also true that you can imagine and you can have wisps of the experience of an extraordinary transaction in the romance arena where you feel unbelievably rewarded by a mate and they feel unbelievably rewarded by you. And this can ignite a love response that might last indefinitely. Now, that is possible, but it's not something that typically happened in the Stone Age. It's not a characteristic of our species. And long-term happy pair bonding between male and female humans is not human nature. It is a possibility of human nature that if you're incredibly lucky, you might discover it. And so the fact that people think that this is somehow their due or that it is supposed to happen, what happens is that they force the issue and they compromise and they try to, they've built institutions around this possibility. And unfortunately, you know, this is a fantasy. And most relationships do not have 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 or more years of excellent steam behind them. They just don't. And so at best, you know what I mean, most relationships have a year. And that's how it really is.
Now, so what are your thoughts on nowadays I hear more and more about polyamory and dating multiple people and being open relationships and things like that. It seems to me that if we're not finding everything in one person, until we do, it seems like polyamory, of course,
yeah.
This is talking from a male where maybe my strategy might be slightly different.
Yes, the poly world is actually a world made up of unusual humans. So these people tend to be more open to experience and therefore they are bored with more routine experiences, And so as a result, this flows over into their sexual psychology as well. And so it's going to be the case that most human females are actually not that adventurous in their sexuality and in their sexual psychologies. So they are, because they can only be impregnated once a year, they're essentially not really interested. It wouldn't be doing a female a lot of good to be sleeping with 8 or 10 different people in a year's time. So their job would be to make an excellent choice of somebody that they would be very interested in. And then the way the female psychology is it's pretty happy with continued sexual activity with the right guy. Now, if it turns out that he's Mr. Wrong, then they're not interested. He may be a real nice guy and all that, but if he's not actually hitting all of her circuits, then he's not hitting her circuits. In the poly world is dominated by male psychology, which is very interested in casual mating strategy. You remember, casual mating strategy of the male means that you have sex with somebody and then you disappear and you potentially impregnate them. Now, keep in mind, the purpose of sex is to impregnate, is for pregnancy. That is its purpose. And in fact, the statistical likelihood of pregnancy in unprotected sex is exceedingly high. People have no idea how high it is. It's 5%. Okay, so as a result, and this is a species where the women are not likely to be impregnatable for 2/3 of the month. So any given sex act is highly potent and has a very good chance of causing pregnancy in our species. So the male, if he can have a lot of different sex partners, that would be highly advantageous for the male. And this is consistent with male psychology. So a male could be very pleased with a pair bond potential partner, but that uniform interest is not going to last too long. You know, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, that male's eye is going to start to wander. And his behavior may not wander because it may be too expensive to threaten a good pair bond and also to have to try to have two relationships going at the same time. But most of the women, that remember, the average guy is sleeping up in a pair bond. So in order to sleep up twice at the same time, the whole point to a pair bond for a female is to get a bunch of resources. That's an extremely critical point. So a male trying to hold down two pair bonds at the same time is a guy without any time or energy left over. So he's probably not going to be able to pull it off. Now, if you change the situation up slightly and you have the male be very sexually attractive, and so he's a 95th percentile sexually attractive male, his mate is in the same territory as that. However, he is able to use his highly sexual attractiveness in order to get females that are still very sexually attractive, interested in him, even for casual mating. That guy probably will behave that way. And so the poly world is a world where males are admitting that, you know what, I'm just so open to experience, I just cannot get into this idea of being with one female forever. I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. And the females that are in the poly world are also highly open to experienced females who undoubtedly had philandering fathers who had the genes to be highly philandering. So the females are also of this wild ilk. And so you have an actually unusual looking situation that you don't typically see in human nature. So the poly world is not a world of bright, informed, open to ideas, people that are actually on the cutting edge of anything. What you actually have is an unusual mixture of personalities that, as a result of their unusual personality structure, are attempting to live a lifestyle in a way that that is getting around some of the inherent conflicts of interest between male and female. It is not a prescription for humanity to find any happiness in. It's not a solution to anything. It's simply a derivative of what comes out of some unusual personality types.
Very interesting. And so what in your opinion is the prescription for a happiness outcome for males, females in terms of love, sex, relationships, dating, marriage,
I think the ideal thing is exactly kind of what it is that you see, what you're watching in young people, before 30, that haven't been pressured by any churches into getting married. In other words, you're seeing people that are oftentimes not all yet focused on settling in, making babies, and having to worry about all the financial implications and the lifetime implications of that. So most strategies for optimizing human happiness are built around Parabon strategy, because that is a dominant characteristic in human nature for both males and females. The males are very competitive, and they are wanting to sleep up with sexually attractive, interesting females. The females are wanting to only fall for guys who are pretty close to them in terms of attractiveness, but are also very accomplished and very, very into them. Their happiness is optimized by males who can generate resources and are willing to share them in what is, in fact, a Parabon process. However, the wise would say you don't get married, you discover if you are. Too many people are in a rush to essentially to fall into the trap of getting married, and that trap is a societal monster in many ways that ignores some very profound facts about human biology. The concept that we should be having that is more accurate for human nature is that these relationships should utilize birth control to the nth degree, and that people should enjoy themselves for as long as they enjoy each other's company. And then when they no longer consider that partner to be an excellent choice relative to their options, then they fall out of love, and that they do not catastrophize over this, and they move on. And your relationships may last for a few months, or they may last for a few years. A person may find themselves in a relationship with multiple years behind it and no end in sight. And that if you find yourself in such of a situation where you're 4 or 5 years in and you are extremely happy on both sides of the equation, then you are married. Now, you can now get married if you want, but you are married. You discover whether you are married. You don't make it happen. And so that is the correct prescription for human happiness. If you are ever so lucky as to have that happen, then great. There's no reason to force the issue ever. And people force the issue consistently.
Yeah, I've had some friends over the years where they had, 9-year relationship before they got married, 5 years, 3 years. A year after they get married, they can't, ends up falling apart. And listening to some of what you were talking about a couple of shows ago about the high cost of expectations, it seems to me that this is a huge ego trap that people can put themselves in with the family and friends, of expecting that now that you have a piece of paper that says you're married, now you have all these extra expectations that you previously did not have.
Yeah, you know what? That's bogus. If you're in a relationship for 9 years and then you get married, and then it goes south, let me tell you, it was south before they got married. Mm-hmm. What happened almost inevitably is the female pushed the male into it. The male was not into it, didn't want to do it, and was hanging around because he was attached to the female as a friend and was not really that into her. and she was considered him absolutely acceptable and wanted to just make it official, etc. That was a mistake. So those people made the mistake of trying to get married rather than discover whether they were. If your guy is not that into you, if he's still not chasing you around a little bit, if he's not pestering you a little bit for sexuality 6 years in, if he's not into it, if he's not giving you signals that you are number one and he's very interested, and that his wandering eye is fairly muted, if that is not your experience, you're in the wrong place. You are not married. And this is what you may have is a nice guy that is that doesn't want to face the breakup. And this is a problem when people cohabit. They think they're being cool and wise and cutting edge and smart. But the truth of the matter is that they're raising the barrier to exit out of relationships that have gone flat. There is no, absolutely no shame in a relationship that goes 3 years, 4 years, 6 years, and then goes flat. That is characteristic of the species, folks. That is no cause for lamenting what went wrong and to be crying about the cruelty of the situation, or that if he would just get counseling, or that we would remove his barriers to commitment, or any of this other nonsense. Okay? This is characteristic of the species. When the love and the joy and the sexuality and the excitement and the happiness are not an emergent property of the relationship, it's time to leave. Okay? It's not time to fix it. It's time to leave it. And that's when, you know, obviously if you have children involved, that's a whole different, you know, Rubik's Cube to try to figure out. But we have to understand that our expectations for love are too high. They are too high. People believe that they want this great feeling that they have on their 27th birthday with Mr. Right to last forever. And the truth is we have to be accepting and humble about the fact that it may last for 2 years. And if it does, it was worth having. Okay, but we don't wreck the next 50 trying to recapture the first two. We move on.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.